Good morning, everyone. A warm welcome to all of you. It's my first time to participate in this gathering, and happy that we managed to conduct it virtually. My name is Sarah Hamouda. I manage some projects at the African Peer Review Mechanism under Agenda 2063 unit. It's our flagship agenda for socioeconomic development and meets also Agenda 2030 for sustainable development goals. Today's session, or our first session, actually focuses on the knowledge systems and knowledge production on the continent. And as you know, Africa now is facing unprecedented times due to COVID-19. The healthcare sector, or SDG 3, which aims to ensure health and well-being in Africa, has severe challenges. We have different issues related to expenditure on healthcare in Africa, on reporting on health data, as well as also the commitment of African countries to apply disaster framework to mitigate crisis related to health issues. So our session simply focuses on discussing how countries can leverage reserve funds to improve investigations on COVID-19, as well as for research through think tanks and higher learning institutions such as the University of Cape Town. We're going to discuss the interface between research and policymaking and how can we improve it, as well as how does Africa or African countries define the future post COVID-19, and what resources should be invested in education and training to achieve a better future for African citizens. I'm very much honored to moderate this session with four distinguished speakers. Our first speaker is Dr. Salim Fakir, I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, who is the Executive Director of the African Climate Foundation in South Africa. He has over 20 years of experience in the field of renewable energy policy and financing. And also Dr. Salim served on the executive board of the WWF South Africa as head of the policy and future unit for more than 11 years.
Thank you. First, a correction. I'm not a doctor, and you know, in South Africa, if you somebody calls you a doctor, you need to be you need to correct it very immediately. But I wanted to really thank you, Sarah, for the kind introduction, and also to thank UCT and APRM and the Nelson Mandela School of Governance for this wonderful opportunity to share thoughts on, I think, a very important topic, and it's at the heart of the work the African Climate Foundation is doing. I also want to just say we've actually started a new institution, and I think it's wonderful that we can participate in Africa Day this soon, because we literally started the 1st of April, and we're continuing to build what I think would be a very important institution, with important links to all of you and to develop the work as we go along in partnership with you. The African Climate Foundation will have a hub in South Africa, and with time we will establish operational presence in Ethiopia and Kenya. Hopefully we'll also, when we're in Ethiopia, work very closely with the AU and other AU-related institutions. If you talk about climate change and COVID and any thing that requires scientific information to feed policy, evidence-based work is very vital and essential part of that. And we know that in the context of COVID-19, the countries and leadership and policymakers that adhere to the science are proving to be more successful in dealing with the crisis than those who have relied on very spurious notions of what the cause of the virus is, or how to solve a very troubling and emergent crisis that we are all part of at the present moment. So this aspect of knowledge and how we understand knowledge and how we use evidence-based work to inform policy is a very important aspect of some of the lessons we're going to learn from COVID-19. We know that willful ignorance and willful practice based on ignorance that doesn't at least take into account the best science that we have, does lead to death. And we are seeing that play itself out in countries. I don't have to mention names. It's very widely known in the newspapers. And you just have to look at the relationship between ignorance, lack of knowledge, or at least not accepting prevailing scientific knowledge and the cause of death. The similar kind of issues are playing themselves out in climate science. And we know about fake news. We know about dissent around climate science. These are all attempts to undermine decision makers' ability to think about the long run and to actually turn scientific knowledge into practical value and to be able to use that to deal with what is already a crisis and will continue to be a crisis in the future. On the topic about knowledge production and knowledge, let me divide my inputs into three parts. I want to make some philosophical remarks because I think it's important to understand our premises with relationship to what we mean by knowledge. I want to talk about the relationship between knowledge, truth, and practice, because I think that's very important. And we are in with regard to that category, we are seeing at the present moment the troubling relationship between truth and practice. And let me then talk about knowledge in practice. And I Sarah, if I'm going over time, please stop me, and I might not complete all my comments. But
I'm sorry, I forgot to say that each speaker has 10 to 15 minutes.
Okay, so I'll try to be as succinct as possible. I think that we have to recognize that knowledge is fundamental at three levels, and I'm talking about different kinds of knowledge, not just the stuff that is done in laboratories or churned out of scientific institutions, but local knowledge and forms of practice that involves observations of life and nature, knowledge from practice, that is from experience and doing things. And I think that we can also reflect that the fact that Africa has had to deal with Ebola and many other kinds of epidemics has given us knowledge from practice and has taught us ways to deal with COVID-19 in a very robust way. And there's also hidden knowledge that comes from not only experience, but intuition and wisdom. I think the importance of the last part is that you can have the best science, you can have the best decision makers, but if they do not have the right intuition and wisdom that comes from where they are sitting, they could make the wrong calls and the wrong judgments. And we can see that also playing itself out in the conflicts around science and what the decision should be around how to manage a crisis like COVID. So this raises important points around the role of universities. And it's clear that university education is insufficient. It may help us to deal with the first part, which is around observations of life and nature, but maybe insufficient condition to attain other forms of knowledge, which do not emphasize just aspects of analytical skills, but also the depth of knowledge we can gain from the practice of disciplines, the experience we have in exercising disciplines. And often we find that many university students that come out of university may have strong analytical skills, but do not have depth of experience in a discipline, as often are ill-prepared to deal with real-life challenges when they just come out of university. So the role of universities in bridging this divide between analytical skills, experience, and ability to make good and sound judgment is something that I think we have to develop a way of closing the circle, if you want. Universities play an important role and they provide a foundation for us to achieve great heights in understanding knowledge. But the rest of is all up to us. And so every student that or person that learns new skills and knowledge in universities should not end their career in a particular discipline, but actually take advantage of the age of digitization to learn more things and also to practice. However, to deal with complex and challenging problems in society, it's insufficient just to rely on science, but also practice, that experience and knowledge that comes out of practice. We've got to learn by doing, and this is, in many cases, we know that there's a lot of talk, and we've had talk about boosting industrial development on the continent. We know that it's insufficient to know what industrial development is and have ideas about it, but we have to find ways on the continent to actually practice industrial development, because by learning by doing is more important than theorizing about what industrial development is. And this applies to all kinds of fields that we want to nurture and develop on the African continent. I want to say that with regard to knowledge, truth and practice, and I want to talk about this from a point of view of the field that I'm very familiar with. We know this issue quite well, that even though truth is spoken about certain things, it doesn't mean that that easily translates into decisions in practice. For a long time, and it still continues, climate science has been subjected to spurious claimants of knowledge and science to place in our minds doubts about the science, so that we do not act in a timely way around this. We've seen this actually with COVID-19 as well, that it's not a black swan, it was a white swan, in a sense that people were aware that another pandemic will hit. But as you can see, many governments and society as a whole did not prepare for this. And the similar kinds of things play itself out around the climate crisis. These tactics of doubting the science, which ironically is also playing itself out while the COVID-19 crisis is on, has been well documented by scholars such as Naomi Oreska and others. And the strategy is a well-known one. It is, we've seen it with tobacco and many other things like lead pollution, any factors that cause disease or disrupt society. The first tactic is to deny, to plant false science, to attack the messenger, to wage a media campaign against the science, and to put one group of scientists against another. And often in the climate science domain, people who have certain kinds of degrees, but who are not really so often experts in a particular field, are asked to comment on stuff that often they do not know much about. But the credentials and the label of scientific authorities used to cast doubt. So I think, as in the COVID-19, and it will play itself in, and it's continuing to play itself in the in the climate science, that what is truth these days is a contested space. Often scientific authority is put under question. We have this problem of different sources of evidence, and this is made even worse by the fact that while the internet is a profound tool to learn new things, it's also a profound tool to disseminate false information and false science. And so we have to contend with insertion of fake news. Again, this has happened with COVID-19. And it's led to compounding in problems in the public mind, and what is authoritative knowledge, and who can we trust, and has implications for how we use such knowledge in the domain of practice and action. We can see some of this come out live with COVID-19. Let me try to conclude with some closing remarks. In terms of the African continent, it's important that we try to not only encourage the development of analytical skills, but we actually find at a regional, at a national level, mechanisms for different disciplines to be exercised in practice, and for valuable experience to be gained that is able to translate what one could describe as universal sources of knowledge and science to specific conditions on the African continent. But as I've articulated in my opening remarks, we also have to be cognizant of the fact that having sound analytical skills, having the best knowledge, does not translate into good judgment, often at the levels of policy and leadership. And this is a challenge we are going to face not only on the African continent, but worldwide, as to how knowledge and practice can be used to ensure good judgment, and so that society can not only benefit from the best evidence, but also the way in which the best evidence is used to make sound practices and judgments as we go along. So I thought I'll insert those comments, and they are philosophical, but they also are based on experiences we all have, we've had around COVID-19, and certainly in the field of climate science, one encounters these kinds of issues with the relationship between evidence, practice, and sound judgment. So I would love to leave it at that for summary. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Salim. I think you gave us a few significant takeaways regarding linking knowledge and practice with decision-making, wisdom, judgments, and also decision-taking and crisis management. You also highlighted the importance of bridging between the analytical skills and also policy judgments at policy-making level. I think we are on some questions. We received some questions regarding, for instance, how can for an ordinary African to be reoriented to think in terms of co-production, especially taking into account our local research knowledge to inform policy. Of course, our colleague, he was given some, Brian Nabusiu, yes. He was speaking about the Africa's dependency on aid and foreign aid assistance to reallocate budget and funds for healthcare. And then he asked this question. I think there was also another question on how do we engage with indigenous well-being knowledge systems post COVID-19? Dr. Salim, Mr. Salim, it's yours.
Sure. I also saw a question around the adverse effects of climate change. So I'll try to answer them as short as possible. I think on the first question, there was a wonderful discussion yesterday under the African Free Trade Continental Agreement. And this particular question that's been asked, I think has been adequately debated and analyzed and answered in that meeting yesterday. And how to deepen manufacturing industrial capability and beneficiation on the African continent, and how to use the free trade agreement as a mechanism for that. I would say that people should listen to that talk. I think it will be available publicly by UCT, and there's been lots of good experts who have engaged the issue. So I won't answer the question in a lot more detail because there's been enough coverage of that yesterday. So I just encourage people to look at that. On indigenous knowledge, in my past work, I was working a lot on the Convention on Biological Diversity, and one of my areas of interest many years ago was around the use of indigenous knowledge, and which have over generations has been developed around the use of plant material for healing and so on. I think the best way to answer this is to say that first that indigenous knowledge and its value has to be recognized. And the second part is that a lot of that knowledge is part of communities that have sustained it over generations, and that knowledge is being lost. And so we have to find ways in which research and academic institutions are able to capture that. There is some effort around that, but insufficient. A third part, in terms of its relationship to medicine, we have to find mechanisms of officially giving authorization for such indigenous knowledge to be used in primary healthcare, as one example of it. And we see that China has actually done that with barefoot doctors. Now, not all indigenous practice and use of knowledge can cure all diseases, but I think there's some value in understanding which ones of those practices that have been taking place over generations can be of value to people at primary healthcare level. And partly the reason for that is that people don't often have good access and often sources of income to access modern medicine. And there should be a first line of preference, if you want, where people can access indigenous knowledge and medical practices from immediately within their local vicinity. So there's some value in that, but we need to systemize that, recognize it, and kind of regulate it if you want, because people are using it, and there's lots of experience to show that. On the effects of climate change and decision makers, if I can answer the question of Samuel, I think there's a lot of impacts of climate change. You can look at the impacts that Hurricane Idai has done. We are learning a lot from the COVID experience of the intersection between crisis and health effects. In this case, it's a very direct health effect, but in the future, if we study climate change, particularly around issues of air pollution, or when an extreme weather pattern happens, there are certain services and facilities like electricity is cut off, there are flooding, which can extenuate malaria, dengue fever, and so on. These intersections are well known, actually, and people have experienced them directly. I think most policymakers that avoid making investments in rectifying this, like we're beginning to see and has been argued around healthcare issues, we need to learn to make those long-term investments to prevent situations where climate crisis or extreme weather patterns often translate into economic, social, and health issues. So it is not, I wouldn't say that policymakers don't know this. Policymakers may not have the resources or are postponing decisions because they think that climate change is something that's going to happen in the future. So not to fast forward some of these decisions as they should be doing. Thank you.